It is worth pointing out that there is no inherent antipathy between Darwinian concepts of evolution and yogic theories. Yoga has faith in the existence of God, but it does not see God as a puppet master pulling the strings of a trillion marionettes simultaneously. The world, as we experience it, is connected to and imbued with the reality of cosmic soul, but it is not directly manipulated by it. This way of looking at things is entirely in sympathy with yogic attitudes. Yoga agrees, which is why it is deemed to be a dualistic philosophy, nature on the one hand, soul on the other. To yoga, nature is nature and spirit is spirit. They intercommunicate, and the spiritual soul is supreme, the abiding reality. But we must take nature seriously as we belong to it and live in it. To dismiss it as an illusion by a philosophical sleight of hand is to the yogic mind naive. To accept visible nature as the only reality is ignorance personified. To the yogi, nature is a mountain to be climbed. Yoga sees the origin of nature as a root. In Sanskrit, it calls it root nature, mula prakriti. Within that root, as we saw earlier, exist certain unstable but creative propensities called the qualities of nature, the three gunas, mass or inertia, tamas, dynamism or vibrancy, rajas, and luminosity and serenity, sattva. In the root of nature, they are balanced in equal proportions. They exist only as a potential. They do, however, partake of nature's enduring characteristic. They are unstable. They shift. It is their destiny to fidget and form. And form they do, but gradually. The subtle precedes the gross, or as we would say, the invisible comes before the visible. Cosmic intelligence, Mahat, which exists in all of us, is the first manifestation of the invisible. From cosmic intelligence sprouts cosmic energy, prana, and consciousness, chitta, and from these devolves ego, ahamkara, or the sense of self. From the one root comes duality, which is the ability to separate. From duality comes vibration, which is the pulse of life beginning. From vibration comes invisible manifestation. And from the invisible comes the visible in all its glorious and horrendous diversity and multiplicity. This end product is what we take the world to be, our playground, our paradise, or our hell and our prison. If we misapprehend nature, take it at face value through ignorance, avidya, then it is our prison. The path modern science has taken to escape from the prison is analytical. Science dissects, whether it be frogs, human bodies, or atoms. It seeks truth in intrinsic minutiae. But if you take apart a watch, you may understand how it works. However, you will no longer be able to tell the time. Yoga also dissects ego, mind, intelligence, for example, but it is not only analytical. It is synthetic, too, or integrationist. It examines in order to know, like science, but it wants to know in order to penetrate, to integrate, and to reconstruct through practice and detachment the perfection of nature's original intention. In other words, it wants to reach the root and cut out the intervening turbulence. It does not want to be hoodwinked by nature's appearance, but to adhere to its original motivation. The difference between yoga and Darwin lies in the theory of natural selection by the random mutation of genes, which provides survival advantages on a haphazard basis. If it is the subtle which clothes itself in the form of the gross, this cannot be. 2 centuries earlier, Isaac Newton followed the yogic line. He said, "The order which reigns in the material world indicates sufficiently that it has been created by a will which is filled with intelligence." This clearly is not the puppet master creator, but an innate natural intelligence seeking to express itself. But do not forget that order and chaos make strange bedfellows, and the results are unpredictable. Yoga would say that this unpredictable diversity stems from the intelligent will and life force of nature, struggling to express itself in more and more ways, like an actor who wants to take on as many different roles as possible. To yoga, the code embedded in DNA is not some inexorable deterministic force. It is deterministic to the extent that it carries the code of past karma, but it is also the will of nature seeking freedom through individualization. To take an example, the particularity of the flounderfish, which has two eyes on one side of its head, lies in the bottom of the seabed, and is dark for camouflage only on one side, is not the result of a freak mutation, but the flounder's response to the challenge of existence in a dangerous world, animated from within and motivated by an unconscious cellular intelligence. The reason behind our exploration of the elements and their subtle counterparts is to penetrate into the evolving heart of nature, to catch it before it shows up in obvious objects like trees and tables, hotels, saris, and motor cars. Beyond even that lies our wish to reconcile the gunas, the unstable qualities of nature, which lend it both its creative and transient characteristics. At a material level, inertia, mass, tamas predominates, which is why it hurts when you stub your toe on a table leg. At a psychosensory level, dynamism, rajas, and luminosity, sattva, are predominant, which is why studying for an exam can be an exhilarating experience. Shame over a mean action can be fiery torture, and a job well done can be a source of sattvic serenity. The yogi aims to be one who can restore the gunas to their original proportions and then draw them all back up in a stable form into the root of nature, and so transcend their vicissitudes. Henceforth, he is unshaken by the turbulence of nature. This does not mean you are in feeling. I referred earlier to the loss of my wife and the fact that I did not cry. Do not think that I did not and do not still feel it as much as any man. The yogi is human. In fact, through the compassion he gains, he's the most human of humans. Nevertheless, in the transcendent but razor-alert piece of meditation, he views life from the summit of Mount Nature. The qualities of nature, gunas, have until now been treated as the most arcane of esoteric knowledge, unsuitable for the general public. I do not believe in that attitude. I suffered from it when my own guru said I was unfit for pranayama. Yet the subject is difficult, and so for the sake of the general reader, I will offer one last analogy. In all phenomena, the three gunas are present, but always in variable proportions. As the proportions change, so do natural phenomena emerge, which we call birth, grow and decay, which we call existence or life, and disappear again, which we call death. The odd but striking parallel which I offer you is not supported by scientific knowledge on my part. It is Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, in which E is energy, M is mass, tamas, and C is the speed of light, sattva. Energy, mass, and light are endlessly bound together in the universe. An analogy of this might be that light itself, sattva, displays in physics dual attributes. It's neither a wave nor a particle. Yet depending on the method of observation used, it can be perceived as either a discrete photon, tamas, with a specific location, or as a wave, rajas. Even at our more prosaic level, we can learn to observe the changing interplay of these three properties. There's a practical point to this. Once the principles of nature have been withdrawn into their root, their potential remains dormant, which is why a person in the state of samadhi is but cannot do. The outward form of nature has folded up like bird's wings. If the practitioner does not pursue his practice with sufficient zeal, but rests on his laurels, even at this point, the principles of nature will be reactivated to ill effect. Many are the God-men who have fallen. Yoga is involution. We all want to develop and improve ourselves. We think of this as personal evolution and a spreading of our wings. The true yogic journey is involution, or folding one's wings. If evolution is a preparation for yoga, the intention to unite with the soul, then involution is actual yoga, union itself. We struggle from the gross material world into the subtle heart of nature, like salmon returning to their source for both death and regeneration. The force which is expressing itself welcomes our journey, even though it seems to obstruct it. So we must do everything we can to encourage our development through asana practice and stopping our self-destructive habits, such as smoking or overeating. We also use our will, not ego, but our nature's life essence, to favor the struggle. And we invoke divine aid in an act of surrender and humility. The combination of these three makes the journey possible. Let's take two examples. In relation to what I have just said, of how one might attempt to change one's life, let us imagine a man, short of money and in a dead-end job. He is anxious, stressed, frustrated, and irritable with his wife and children. On Friday nights, he tries to escape his predicament by drinking too much. What can he do? What does he do? He makes the effort not to go out drinking. This is already a small victory, but what can he do then with the money he has saved? He can go and buy a lottery ticket or several. The odds are against him. Firstly, because he is behaving weakly. It is his ego which is asking God to let him win, and there's no role for the exertion of his own will. To buy a ticket requires little effort, and there's nothing practical he can do to make his ticket win. The only thing he can do is not lose the ticket. All parts are weak. His divine relationship, his natural life force, his practical action. This is the feebleness of fantasy and tenuous connections. Let us say he takes a different course of action. He spends the little money he has saved on an evening course to improve his skills. Ethically, he strives to improve his relationship with his wife and children, recognizing that whether the fault is his or not, the solution is in his hands. This is a purifying process and one involving sustained personal effort and sacrifice. He asks God from a humble heart to help him find a better job and endure better the one he has. Nothing happens. Time passes, the economy improves. His new skills are noticed as well as his new maturity at work. He is promoted and has prospects. The strain at home is relieved at every level. This is not a fairy tale. Our man has made valid connections, shown patience and perseverance, tapas, physical prowess, shakti, study, swadhyaya, intellectual skills, yukti, and devotion, bhakti, in the chosen path. His outward change of fortune expresses a powerful inner change. He has brought nature and soul into closer harmony, and the result is what we call success and happiness. You may be surprised that I use such mundane examples talking of samadhi, but do not forget that it is all the eight petals of yoga which form the flower. Perhaps for the man above, his samadhi was a worthwhile career and a happy home life. Equally, the highest practitioner who abandons the two petals of the ethical base will fall. So many people approach spiritual growth as if it were a lottery. They hope that some new book or new method, some new insight or teacher will be the lottery ticket that allows them to experience enlightenment. Yoga says no. The knowledge and the effort are all within you. It is as simple and as difficult as learning to discipline our own mind and heart, our body, and breath. Samadhi is ultimately a gift from the divine, but how do we make ourselves worthy to receive this gift? We must return to the subtle, but also to the all-pervasive cosmic energy, breath, prana. I have mentioned that it's the first form to evolve from cosmic intelligence. The term breath is inadequate to express its scope, its ability to act as the messenger of the gods. According to the Upanishads, it is the principle of life and consciousness. It is even equated with the soul. It is the breath of life in all manifestations of the universe, whether they physically breathe or not. The animate are born through it and live by it, and when they die, their individual breath redissolves into the cosmic breath. It is breathtaking. It is survival. Not the individual survival our ego craves, but survival and perpetuation nonetheless. Our breath returns to the cosmic wind. The Hebrew of the Bible conveys the same insight as the individual ruach, breath, spirit. It is the same word as the cosmic ruach, wind, spirit, that in the creation story hovered over the deep. Prana, because it evolves directly from cosmic intelligence, carries an ongoing record which is never terminated and cannot be destroyed. I use the simile of the salmon swimming back up the torrent towards its source, as we are trying to do. I said that the current seems to obstruct and oppose us. Prana furnishes us with the fins and flashing tail which enables us to leap the torrent. It, above all in nature, is attracted towards source, in a parallel sense to the longing of the individual soul for reconciliation with its universal origin. I was touched and interested to see, very recently, the humble admission by Stephen Hawking, the great Cambridge astronomer, that he has changed his mind on an important issue. Until now, he has claimed that whatever enters into a black hole in space can never emerge again, not even light, because the gravitational pull is too strong. Now he says that he has discovered evidence which proves that what he calls information does escape from black holes. Prana is the vehicle of cosmic intelligence, which others might call information, and to the yogic way of thinking, Professor Hawking's new view can only seem right. Prana is both being, sat, and non-being, asat. It is the source of knowledge, and in no part of the universe can it be absent or finally imprisoned. Remember that knowledge has a beginning but no end. A black hole is non-being, but even that will change again into being. Prana presents us with this paradox. It is the most essential, real, and present feature of every moment of our lives, and yet it remains the most mysterious. How can we reconcile this fact within our practice? How do we relate Professor Hawking's theories on the macrocosm to our practice in the microcosm? When we are in the suspension of breath in the deepest meditation, a spontaneous, as it were, God-willed retention, we enter the black hole, the vortex of nothingness, the void. Yet somehow we survive. The curtain of time, time which inexorably brings death, is parted. This is a state of non-being, but living non-being. It is a present devoid of past and future. There is no self, no meditator, no longer even any breather. What comes out of the black hole, that nothingness? Information. What is the information? The truth. What is the truth? Samadhi. Samadhi. In effect, what I have just said is that the mind is a bottomless pit, like a black hole. Stop trying to fill it, as it cannot be filled. Go beyond the bottomless pit to realize the soul. For the beginner, samadhi is an alluring subject, but there are reasons not to get fixated on it. The beginner can only conceive of samadhi as the glorification of the self he knows. In the same way, every beginner who picks up a tennis racket dreams of winning Wimbledon or the U.S. Open. Often beginners in yoga indulge in fantasies of an easy samadhi, and there are those who are only too ready to take advantage of their gullibility. Samadhi has to come in its own. It's inexpressible. You cannot even ask someone who's been in meditation, "Did you meditate for 2 hours?" How could he know? It's a state outside time. Meditation is going from the known to the unknown, and then coming back to the known. It's impossible to say, "I'm going to meditate," or "I meditated for 2 hours." If we know it lasted for 2 hours, we were in the self, and not in the infinite, where time, in the linear sense, no longer exists. This holds true even more of samadhi. Nobody can say, "I am in samadhi." One cannot talk or communicate. Samadhi is an experience where the existence of I disappears. Explanation can only come through the presence of I, so samadhi cannot be explained. We are now in the innermost sheath, or causal body, where we can see that we are divine, and the self with a small s is replaced by the big S self, as we truly understand at the core of our being that our individual soul is part of the universal soul. It is said that the meaning of life becomes apparent in the face of death. At this point in practice, the ego dissolves, or rather, it gives up its impersonation of the true self. This is the culmination of yoga, samadhi, blissful absorption, the final freedom whereby the individual soul merges in the ocean of being. All this time, we have identified ourselves with our body, our organs, our senses, our intelligence, our ego. But here, we are totally with the soul. In meditation, consciousness faces the soul itself. Samadhi is seeing the soul face to face. It is not a passive state. It is a dynamic one in which the consciousness remains in a state of equilibrium in all circumstances. The disturbance of the mind and emotions fade away, and we are able to see true reality. Our consciousness, clear of thoughts and emotions, becomes transparent. It becomes crystal clear as both memory and intelligence are cleansed. As the flawless crystal reflects any color without blurring or admixture, our consciousness, when it is pure and untainted by disturbances, reflects the object of thought clearly. Whether we look at our work, our marriage, or children, we do so clearly and without the clutter of pollution. We are able to see the truth. When the clouds covering the sun move away, the sun shines brilliantly. In the same way, when the covering of the self in the form of afflictions, disturbances, and impediments is removed, the self shines brilliantly in its own glory. After significant effort, a yoga practitioner reaches a state where some asana poses are effortless. What we achieve here externally is achieved through samadhi internally. It is an effortless state where one experiences the grace of the self. This is a state of great bliss and fulfillment. Samadhi can be explained by the head, which does not embody the real truth, as samadhi can only be experienced by the heart. Few of us may get all the way to samadhi, but we are concerned here with evolution and progressive growth and change. And it is this growth and change, this ever greater ability to see the truth, that will allow us to live increasingly in freedom. There are problems with samadhi as there are with every other petal of yoga. For example, if someone asks the question of a saint, "Are you a saint?" there's no truthful answer, as it is an experience out of time and space, without historical record. What is the answer? If a saint says, "Yes, I am," he becomes a non-saint, a liar in that moment, because he is not in samadhi when he replies. He can only reply from his present self. If he replies, "No, I am not," he is a liar too, as he has touched the state of samadhi and seen the ultimate reality. It's not a question which can be asked or answered. As for myself, I am often reluctant to declare that I am a yogi. I can only say that I am on the path and I am very near. I can say I'm a forerunner, no doubt. I am near the goal. Let it come on its own. I have no motive. I had lots of motives in the early days. I have no motive now. My motive is only to continue what I learned so that I may not slip back. It is not an ambition, but I do not want to have a fall, anavasti tattva, and I do not want to develop the character of tamasic nature in my system, that's all. You may ask, why do you practice then? I practice so that the tamasic nature may not dominate over my sattvic nature. Renunciation in practice was my answer to a lot of people who wondered why I continued to practice even after I achieved what I wanted. But by renunciation, I mean freedom from the egoic self. When one stops thinking of the effect or the fruit, it is a deep inward experience. It is not meditation as the term is used today, which is kind of a sedative, a drug, which does not allow full spiritual growth. Dhyana, yogic meditation, is electrifying. Through it, one withdraws from the periphery to the core. This very journey from the periphery to the core is detachment, vairagya. There is a detachment from the effect, an attachment to the soul. One has to transcend the trigunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, while practicing. Only by balancing them to their constituent proportions of one-third each can they be transcended. At that moment, they are reabsorbed into the root of creation without their inherent instability. Since it is sattva which is most lacking, that is why we place primary importance on its cultivation. Samadhi is a state of experience where even the existence of I disappears. That absence of I is a state to be experienced and cannot be explained. But by giving indications on how to live, one can guide the practitioner on the right path. You cannot learn ethics, yama and niyama, through exercises and techniques. The universal ethical fundamentals of yama and niyama can be explained as they are simply principles to be followed. As beginners, we do the best we can, but eventually they have to be applied with full awareness, moment to moment, in any situation, under any circumstances. Yama and niyama have to be inspired by example and mature through practice. Asana, pranayama, and pratyahara, withdrawal from the senses, are based on techniques which can be explained, performed before an expert, and therefore corrected. But dharana, dhyana, and samadhi are experiencing states, not susceptible to tuition through explanation. In the end, you either reach dharana, dhyana, and samadhi or not. If anybody says, "I'm teaching meditation," then, as a student of yoga, I say, "It's rubbish," because meditation cannot be taught. It can only be experienced. Relaxation can be taught and is of immense value. If it leads to serenity and well-being, then it is a form of preparation for meditation, but should not be confused with the real thing. I have mentioned that samadhi has problems. The first is how to conceive of it, as it is unknown, and yet to aspire to it without greed. The second is that, if you experience it, you cannot explain it, since it is indescribable. If one tries to explain the state of samadhi itself, one should suspect that he has fallen into the trap of dishonesty or self-delusion. The third is that even within samadhi, you can get stuck. Traditionally, there is a demarcation of different degrees or qualities of samadhi. I will only take them as two categories. The first group, or lower experiences, are known as sabija samadhi. Sabija means with seed. What this means is that although the experience of bliss is felt, the seeds of desire remain in the ego as future potential. Even after the experience of samadhi, these seeds can sprout again and cause a relapse. The ego has not been entirely purified by the fire of experience. This particular point on the yogic journey, although so elevated, is one of danger, as it can become a wasteland in which the practitioner gets stuck. This state is called manalaya, which means an alert, passive state of mind. But in this context, it implies a complacency with what has been achieved and a tendency to slacken efforts to complete the final step of the journey. The yogi cannot rest in his laurels, but must press on to the higher states of samadhi, in which even the seeds of desire are burnt out from the ego forever, and can never sprout or trouble him again. This is known as nirbija samadhi, seedless, in which the feeling of bliss is not dependent at all, even on a vestigial ego. This is the bliss of the absolute void, of non-being transformed into the light of being. There's a story about this concerning the great 19th century Bengali saint, Sri Ramakrishna. He was a spiritual genius, and from early days slipped easily and unwittingly into a state of seated sabija samadhi. His particular devotion was to the goddess Kali, and in his bliss he was in her presence, in a familiar and divine love. One day, a traveling Vedic monk, an ascetic, came by the temple where Ramakrishna was living and questioned him about his experiences. He suggested that Ramakrishna had the potential to go further and so told him to meditate. This Ramakrishna did and slipped into samadhi, a condition which was by now quite natural to him. Then the monk took a shard of broken glass and pressed it between Ramakrishna's eyebrows. Ramakrishna's reaction to this was both terrible and transcendent. In a spiritual ecstasy, inner bliss, he felt himself with a sword kill his consort goddess, the being he loved and worshipped above all. And so he passed into seedless near Bija Samadhi, the void, the final state of aloneness, a oneness with no other, like the pure beauty of a prime number to a mathematician, an indivisible state. It sounds cruel, but at last he was truly and forever free. He had achieved the ultimate goal of yoga. Lest you think that we are simply in the realm of anecdote and metaphor, I want to express the physical and even the neurological benefits for the bliss of which we speak. It is the reflective processes arising from the back of the brain which also work to lead us toward the state of bliss, which is ananda. The brain stem is the location of asmita, which is the seed of individuality. Above it resides the hypothalamus, which is the neurological nexus of the whole body. Patanjali calls this the place of the moon, Chandrasthana, or Anandasthana, the seat of bliss. It corresponds to the navel, which is the seat of the sun, Suryasthana. There must be perfect alignment between them for energy to flow uninterruptedly and equally. The four spheres of the brain must be in balance. In this way, the human body acts as a spindle, or perfect conductor, between the earth and heaven, linking the two forces which form us through their divine marriage. The lunar plexus keeps our body cool and leads to a cool brain. All pains and pleasures are stored here. It is from this source that one comprehends and lives in the pure and tranquil state of Anandamaya Kosha, experiencing the core of being. What Ramakrishna underwent was the final transformation of consciousness. Patanjali describes this accession to Nirbija Samadhi, seedless bliss, in these words: a new life begins, previous impressions are left behind. When that new light of wisdom is also relinquished, seedless samadhi dawns. Yoga describes seven inner transformations of consciousness. They are purely subjective, that is to say, not visible in any external way. They are known only to the practitioner, which is why describing them is like describing the colors of the rainbow to the blind. But to give an idea of them, I would refer you back to the five objective states of consciousness: right and wrong perception, imagination, sleep, and memory. We know when we are in them, and so to a large extent do other people. We saw that there is much to be learned from them by defining, refining, and cultivating them. Remember that Patanjali recommended the healing states of mind to help us. These were also external or objective, and were friendliness, rejoicing in the success of others, compassion toward suffering, and indifference toward the vice of others, all powerful tools which we can cultivate externally by our behavior. The inner seven states of mind are: 1. The observation of emerging thoughts. 2. The ability to nip them in the bud before they occupy and control our mind. 3. The calm and tranquil state which results from that restraint of rising thought. 4. One-pointed attention, which is the one great tidal wave of concentration on a given object. 5. The cultivated and refined consciousness which results from this combination of both restraint and power. 6. Fissured consciousness. 7. Pure divine consciousness, where the practitioner is alone and at one with all. Any reasonable person must be asking, why is the sixth state, almost the most elevated, defined as fissured consciousness, surely a negative or pejorative description? One-pointed consciousness is like the two edges of the blade. If one is proud of one's achievement, one can be intoxicated by success, and then cracks open up in consciousness, and asmita is tainted. But if one crosses to the other side, consciousness remains pure, and a state of divinity is reached. This is nothing more than the dangerous crossroads of Manalaya, in which the consciousness, through the potential of ego to revive and restore itself, retains its inherent flaws and fault lines. From the exterior, they will be invisible. But until the final dissolution of ego's presence, they lurk, ready to be reactivated under stress or temptation. That is why only seedless samadhi leads to the final solution of self, the final realization of self, and the ultimate freedom from the snares of mortal incarnation. A trivial example of this still slightly imperfect consciousness might be that when, as occasionally occurs, I am invited to conferences with the holy men of India, and indeed from around the world, we all stay in a hotel. I cannot help but notice that many of these holy men are unduly and vastly interested to see who has been given which room, who has the most luxurious room with the best view. It is a sort of hierarchical competition for status. One should not make too much of this, but to my mind, it smacks of something short of perfection and humility. That is why my practice remains unabated. To offer a simile which brings us back to earth, imagine a tennis star, glorious in the prowess of his youthful excellence. Yoga talks of karma, action, jnana, knowledge, and bhakti, devotion. These are three intertwined limbs of yoga. The youthful tennis star is engaged in action, winning tournaments, performing prodigious feats. But there comes a time when the great tennis champion must retire. He cannot beat the young men forever. He loves the game which offered him a life. Perhaps for years he plays in seniors' tournaments. Perhaps he coaches as well to pass on what he knows to future generations and hope that they will outstrip him. He remains faithful to the game and to its traditions in continued well-being. This is bhakti, service and devotion. For the yogi, there's no retirement. But as for the tennis player, there's a change of state, a role both more humble and more exalted. Maybe the tennis player one day will stop. The yogi cannot. Within the physical limits imposed by age, with a lifelong discipline behind him, and with growing love and compassion, he must continue. He does not want a flawed consciousness. He aspires to the goal, the pure, unfissured self, which can never fall back, betray, do disservice, speak untruth, act meanly or selfishly. The yogi is engaged in a game with no end, for the game is simply the sight of his own soul. There has been in recent years a lot of talk about kundalini, as if it were a firework to be set off in the base of the spine with spectacular effects comparable to a 4th of July celebration or the Diwali celebrations. Do not forget that all fireworks come with strict warnings as they are dangerous. You can get badly scarred or worse. Patanjali speaks of the abundant flow of energy in a yogi. Previously, it was known as fire, Agni. Later it came to be called kundalini as the central spinal nerve is kundalakara, coiled 3.5 times. The awakening of kundalini comes with the divine union of body and soul. Like samadhi, it cannot be forced. It is the power of nature, prakriti shakti, which unites with the power of universal soul, purusha shakti. This creates a huge force which needs inner storehouses in which it can be stocked. These storehouses are known as chakra, and in them the confluence of physical, mental, intellectual, spiritual, cosmic, and divine energies takes place. Through the practice of yoga, the flow of these forms of energy can be traced in the visible and invisible bodies and in the known and unknown channels, which transpierce our whole body and are known as nadis. Kundalini is cognate to the experience of samadhi. It is not a shortcut, a mechanical device which can be activated in order to circumvent the long effort of integration of the 5 sheaths of body to soul. I can assure you that everybody seeks samadhi, and most of us seek shortcuts to get there. Those of you modestly struggling to join your hands behind your back, as well as round your knee, after several years of practice of twistings, may well exclaim, "What can samadhi possibly have to do with me?" Well, for a start, By now you have understood that penetration is possible in any asana which you can perform with reasonable proficiency. You may well be going further inside yourself with the few good asanas you can do, rather than the one next to you in class, who can do 40 with apparent ease. That does not mean we should not strive continually to extend our range. A musical composer may not play every instrument in the orchestra perfectly, but if he wants to write a symphony, he must get to grips with the potential of each one. He must find out what it can contribute to the whole, from the French horn to the humble triangle. What do I mean when I say everyone seeks samadhi? Not just through yoga, the slow, sure, safe, and proven method. People seek samadhi through drugs, alcohol, the danger of extreme sports, the romanticism of music, the beauty of nature, the passion of sexuality. There are 1,000 ways, and they all involve the transcendence of the suffering ego and a blissful fusion with an entity much greater than ourselves. When we shed a tear for the two lovers united at the end of a film, or for a character reformed and redeemed, we are expressing our own longing to flee the confines of self, to unite with the greater, to discover, through loss of the known, the endless, gorgeous horizon of the unknown. Some methods of escape are obviously harmful and unsustainable, like drugs or alcohol. Great art, great music, or great works of literature can also begin the work of transformation in the heart of humankind. But I can only honestly teach from what I know. Asana was my school and university. Pranayama was where I earned my doctorate, and it is these yoga practices that I have learned for the path to the blissful fusion. Change leads to disappointment if it is not sustained. Transformation is sustained change, and it is achieved through practice. The vehicle of bliss must be strong, especially its nervous system. The highest bliss transforms permanently. Lesser dreams of divine union, however high their aspirations, contain an element of fantasy. They may not be sustainable. We must have spiritual aspiration, not spiritual pretension. We may find that the stage on which we strut contains trap doors through which we may fall, like careless actors. Remember, the Greek root meaning for actor is hypocrite. Yoga is solid. It is the path I know, the path I trod, the path I teach. Everyone desires relief from both restrictions of personality and its impermanence. Everyone desires samadhi. From the dawn of his history, man has sought dangerous, shoddy shortcuts, as well as noble ones. Call the hard, sustained progress of yoga a long cut, if you will. But if it is a long cut, then so is the flight of an arrow. The final integration of the sheaths of being at last brings access to the knowledge of the soul to join that of the heart and body. Samadhi is only a state where you experience the absorption of the body, mind, and soul as a single unit. But from samadhi, we have to reach a higher and subtler state called kaivalya, eternal emancipation, or freedom in action. I said that in samadhi, you are but cannot do. What is the condition following samadhi in which we can do again, but not as before, acting out of diversity and apparent choice? Can I act out of an undivided self? Can my conscious mind surrender to that which is ever stable and steady? Samadhi, if it was genuine, should have revealed a human intelligence which uncovers the true reality of interconnectivity between people that stems from wisdom, as opposed to the power to control people in a way which comes simply from mental knowledge. The person who has that wisdom and their interactions with the world are based on a different understanding, one founded in compassion and the friendship of both perceived and realized unity. Kaivalya is samadhi in action, and the next subject is how we live with our illumination in the everyday world. Living in freedom. When many of us think of freedom, we believe that it means the pursuit of happiness. Certainly political freedom, as Gandhiji knew, is essential. as the ability to direct our lives is essential for our ability to reach our full potential. Economic freedom is also important, for grinding poverty makes it difficult to think of the life of the spirit. But equally important to political and economic freedom is spiritual freedom. Spiritual freedom actually requires greater self-control and the ability to direct our lives in the right direction. This is the ultimate freedom, which is the fusion of our individual soul with the universal soul, as we release our own wants and wishes for a higher purpose and a higher knowledge of the will of the Absolute in our lives. This final chapter on living in freedom corresponds to the fourth and final chapter of Patanjali's great work. He calls it the Kaivalyapada, the freedom chapter. Actually, he begins his book with samadhi, and then in the second chapter drops right back down to basics, showing how to put one's first foot on the path of the inward journey through the sheaths of being. In his third chapter, he brings us back up to the zenith of yoga, but warns of the dangers on the way if we succumb to the temptations of growing power. His last chapter is the most beautiful and lyrical, enjoying the sweetness of the great task accomplished, yet at the same time he goes out of his way to set our feet back firmly on the ground. Samadhi is an experience which he makes clear is worth struggling to reach. It is transformative and utterly purifying. But what then? Samadhi is a state of being in which you cannot do. You cannot catch a bus when in samadhi. In a state of oneness, how would you be able to discriminate which one to get on? Samadhi leaves the practitioner changed forever, but he still has to get dressed in the morning, eat breakfast, and answer his correspondence. Nature does not simply disappear once and for all. It is simply that the realized yogi is never again unaware of the true relationship between nature and cosmic soul. Ordinary people say, "I live my life." The yogi is aware that it is the divine breath that lives us, and he can see that divine breath in others. His insight penetrates at all times beneath the surface of appearances. Essence is more real than expression. Kaivalya is both freedom and aloneness, but it is the aloneness of a prime number which, indivisible by any other number except oneness itself, lives in an unassailable innocence and virtue. The yogi has experienced the freedom that comes from realizing that life has nothing to do with perpetuating the existence of our mortal self, either in its physical or egoic forms. The yogi has taken the opportunity to encounter the imperishable self before all that is transient disappears as it will, just as a snake sloughs off its old skin. The realized yogi continues to function and act in the world, but in a way which is free. It is free from the desires of motivation and free from the desire of the fruit or rewards of action. He is utterly disinterested, but paradoxically full of the engagement of compassion. He is in the world, but not of it. He is beyond cause and effect, action and reaction. Later, we shall see the role that time plays in this, how there's freedom because the illusion of time no longer exists to bind us to past and future, and so distorts the perfect present. The challenge for the spiritually free person is to live according to five qualities: courage, vitality, right and useful memory, awareness through living in the present moment, and total absorption in his activities. Spiritual maturity exists when there's no difference between thought itself and the action which accompanies it. If there is a discrepancy between the two, then one is practicing self-deception and projecting a false image of oneself. If I am asked to give a demonstration before an audience, then there is bound to be an element of artistic pride in my presentation. But alone, I practice with humbleness and devotion. If one can prevent the inevitable egotism from entering the core of one's life and activities, it means one is a spiritual person. In this state, regardless of the mind, intelligence, and consciousness, he is led from the illuminative wisdom of the core to live a righteous life. He lives from his heart in truth and then expresses it in words. A spiritual man with his knowledge and wisdom perceives the differences of age and intelligence between himself and others, but he never loses sight of the fact that the inner being is identical. Even though he possesses an inner knowledge of such depth and subtlety that he visibly lives in a state of exalted wisdom, he also visibly lives with his feet planted firmly on the ground. He is practical and deals with people and their problems as and where they are. The free man is both innovative and open, even revolutionary, but he will also be steeped in tradition through culture and heredity. The yogi is rooted in his own experiences and the discoveries he has made through yoga practice, yet he must continue with an open mind to catch the subtle discoveries that flash up in the sadhana and use them to further his inner development. While the yogi is grounded in traditional ethics, texts on the science of yoga, and scripture, he has his own authority as a free man. By free, I mean one whose practices have followed the path of detachment and renunciation to their conclusion, which is the unconditioned freedom of Kaivalya. For the average practitioner, remember that learning to live in freedom is a progressive process as we free ourselves from the habits of body, emotions, and mind. As we gain greater skill, we must always be mindful of how to use our growing power ethically. Power. Authority brings power, but the practice of detachment reins in that power, preventing its abuse. The power of psychological insight, which the yogi gains, his ability to read people, should be dedicated to their help and evolution. There is a phrase, "Knowledge is power," which is commonly used to sell newspapers and periodicals. Implicit in that sentiment is the belief that knowledge brings power over others, whereas the yogi's knowledge is introspective and brings power over himself. Allied to discrimination and compassion, that power can be a force for good in the world. The knowledge which devolves from mental cleverness or dexterity, if it is devoid of discrimination and compassion, is heavy with unforeseen consequences. In the case of Faust, he sold his soul to the devil to obtain this power of knowledge. A clever person may discover a cure for malaria or invent a new strain of anthrax for use in biological warfare. The former obviously possesses discrimination, the latter neither wisdom or compassion. This is cleverness, the power of the brain inebriated with itself. Patanjali calls the incidental powers that accrue to the yoga practitioner siddhis. He is very severe in his cautioning against their abuse. He says they should be taken as a sign that we're on the right path and then should be ignored completely. Otherwise, they can become traps which ensnare us in vanity and arrogance. The yogi is, by definition, beyond such self-intoxication. A yogi's actions may each be very small, but if each is perfect in its time and place, their cumulative effect is considerable. And because they are grounded in example, not precept or preaching, there's a snowball effect by which his actions are emulated by others and passed on with compound interest. This snowball effect, which arises from action, which is both genuine and disinterested, is expressed in the biblical injunction, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Each action is a perfect and discrete module, free of unintended knock-on effects. Even with good intentions, clever people never quite know where they're going. The discovery of penicillin saved hundreds of thousands of people from suffering or even death from, for example, sexual diseases. But even today, we all know that sexual license is not free from consequences. My point is not a moral one. It is that what we call good in the world of normal causality can quickly change to what we call bad. The free man, on the other hand, although he still lives in a world of cause and effect, has learned to tread very lightly and to act with great precision. Cleverness, then, acting alone, can be seen as a centrifugal force likely to spin ever faster and to lose control of its original intention. Yogic knowledge is, on the contrary, a centripetal force, forever discarding the irrelevant in order to invest in the search for the core of being where enduring truth resides. For a yoga practitioner, intelligence is not self-aggrandizing, but acts like a scalpel, cutting away all that is unreal so that the real and permanent will be revealed. This leads us directly to an examination of the most difficult asana and to the dimension which mankind has not yet integrated in his consciousness, time. Shavasana and time. I consider Shavasana, or corpse pose, as the most difficult pose. To most of us, it is an agreeable payoff after a hard yoga class in which we feel a relaxation which is either torpid or vibrant, or to some extent, luminous. Luminous here means sattvic, which is both aware and passive. Torpid means tamasic, and as many of my students come to class after a hard day of work, I have never objected to that. It is only natural, and many are the snores which have provided the music that ends a class filled even with my most senior students. I may be a martinet when you are on your feet, but I do not think I've ever woken a student from Shavasana, except possibly in time to send him home. But Shavasana is not about falling asleep. If it were, it would hardly be a difficult pose. Shavasana is about shedding, in the same way that I earlier mentioned the snake sloughing off its skin to emerge glossy and resplendent in its renewed colors. We have many skins, many sheaths, many thoughts, prejudices, preconceptions, ideas, memories, projects for the future. Shavasana is a shedding of all these skins to see how glossy and gorgeous, serene and aware is the beautiful rainbow-colored snake who lies within. We even lie on the ground as the snake does, with the maximum possible surface of our body in contact with the earth. Now, Shavasana is about relaxation, but what prevents relaxation? Tension. Tension results from clutching tightly to life, and in turn, being held by the myriad invisible threads that tie us to the known world, the known I, and the known environment in which it operates. It is the threads that bind the I to its environmental context which give us our sense of identity. My students, as they lie on the floor at the end of a hard class, are still aware that they are husbands or wives, maybe still with shopping to do on the way home, with parents waiting for them there, or children who will want help with their homework. They are tired because they are aware they are businessmen or women who have had a taxing day at the office. Perhaps the day went well. Perhaps not. They are all sons, daughters, husbands, wives, workers, parents, male or female. 1,000 threads of identity bind them to the floor as they lie in Shavasana, like Gulliver imprisoned by the threads of the midget Lilliputians. Shavasana uses techniques of relaxation to cut the threads. The result of this is not, as in meditation, freedom, but loss of identity. I do not say loss of false identity, because in the world in which we function, these identities are real. Yet taking the long view, they are unreal. Even the fact of being male or female is an identity which can be put down. To relax is to cut tension. To cut tension is to cut the threads that bind us to identity. To lose identity is to find out who we are not. Did I not say that intelligence is the scalpel which cuts away the unreal to leave only the truth? As you are lying on the earth in Shavasana, do you not, when the posture is harmonious and balanced, feel both present and formless? When you feel present yet formless, do you not feel an absence of specific identity? You are there, but who is there? No one. Only present awareness without movement and time is there. Present awareness is the disappearance of time in human consciousness. The problem with time is this. We can only conceive of it in spatial terms, like a running river or a piece of string. We divide the string into decades, years, months, days, hours, minutes, and seconds. These are lengths of time, and whatever time is, it is not fair or accurate to treat it as a dimension of space, something to be measured by length, like a wall or a bookshelf. Another problem is that we consider time to be empty, devoid of meaning, like an empty bucket unless we fill it up with something, our activities, for example. Whatever else time is, it must be fully realized in and of itself, in its own nature, like a flower growing in the desert which needs no observer to fulfill the potential of its own beauty. If you try to imagine time without using spatial concepts, you'll find it extremely difficult. That is why I say we have not yet integrated time in our consciousness, as we have done with the three dimensions of space. The power of science is the proof of